Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. There are a few people that we have the privilege of visiting with some regularity, who bring more intelligence to bear on more facets of the war for the free world than our first guest today. He is a friend and very much admired colleague, a senior fellow at the Center for Security Policy, among other things. He is the author of 23 books, the director of Jihad Watch, a Shulman Fellow at the David Horowitz Freedom Center, and an extraordinary contributor to our public understanding of the nature of fundamentals of Islam that are generally either glossed over or ignored altogether or simply misrepresented. And he's a truth teller on all of that. His name, of course, is Robert Spencer. We're always delighted to have him with us. Robert, welcome back. Good to have you.
Thanks. Always good to talk to you, Frank.
So much to visit about. I guess I wanted to start with a piece that you have at jihadwatch.org today, because it sort of sets up a number of the topics that I want to visit with you about. You had a conversation recently with Barry Nussbaum of the American Truth Project about Sharia, this Islamic doctrine, and how it, well, contrasts, shall we say, with the Constitution of the United States and the freedoms that it guarantees. Read us in on the essence of that really important conversation.
Absolutely. Barry was asking me if a Muslim candidate would be respectful of constitutional values in light of the fact that those values often contradict the Sharia values. And this is a question that needs to be asked and needs to be discussed in the public forum, but like so much else, it is ignored and dismissed as Islamophobia. But the reality is that Sharia denies the freedom of speech, denies the equality of rights of women, criminalizes criticism of Islam, is virulently anti-Semitic, and there's so much more that contradict American law and American values. And so the question has to be asked that when you have a pro-Sharia international organization, such as the Muslim Brotherhood, in its entities in the United States working to elect Muslim candidates, what is going to be the loyalty of those candidates? And ultimately, whether we are willing to discuss this question or not, it's going to be unavoidable.
Loyalty is, of course, a loaded term. What you're really talking about is an incompatibility in terms of the objectives of Sharia, not just some of its, you know, tenets and the practices that it either, you know, demands devout Muslims follow or eschew, as the case may be. And you're right, absolutely, that the Constitution of the United States is antithetical in a number of respects to what Sharia requires. Few people have done more to document that than you, Robert Spencer. But it's the end state as much as it's the sort of practices that are of concern here, is it not?
Yeah, absolutely. The question of somebody observing Sharia provisions regarding Islamic religious observance, there's no objection to that whatsoever. And this is used to confuse the issue to a tremendous degree by groups such as the Council on American Islamic Relations and its allies. They claim that people who oppose Sharia are trying to restrict Islamic religious practice. Actually, there's no problem with Islamic religious practice whatsoever unless it violates American laws. And that's the problem where Sharia does involve. I mean, that's the problem in that Sharia does involve some practices and beliefs that are in contradiction to American laws and mores. And consequently, there's going to be a conflict whether we want to face that fact or not.
And for example, jihad is mandated by Sharia, and it's not just the personal struggle for self-improvement kind, is it? And again, what I'm really getting at, Robert, is to what end? The jihad is not just, you know, the expression of your devotion to Islam by, well, perhaps murdering unbelievers or others. It's to the end of creating a Sharia compliant caliphate, is it not? And that's what ultimately is thwart the loyalty question of people who espouse, embrace Sharia and our constitution, which has a very different governing structure and character than does a caliphate, to say the least.
That's right. And that's the whole point of jihad. Jihad is not just undifferentiated mayhem in its violent manifestation. It's designed in order to destabilize and ultimately destroy non-Muslim or even Muslim governments that don't follow Sharia and replace them with Sharia governments. And so if you have someone who's committed to that in principle, even if he's never going to take up arms, then it raises the question of how faithful a servant he can be of a polity, a political system that he believes in principle to be illegitimate. But these are questions that we're not allowed to ask.
Well, and I'm so proud of you for asking them and incessantly trying to make sure that the rest of us do the same. And to your point, Robert, when you talk about the individual embracing this end state and what Sharia, you know, requires in it, it doesn't have to be taking up arms to engage in the violence yourself. It is, as I understand it, at least as valued to be supporting the jihad financially or in other ways. Is that correct?
Yes. There are all sorts of jihads because, of course, the word in Arabic means struggle. There can be jihad of the pen, jihad of the tongue, that is defending Islam from perceived attacks, trying to advance the cause of Sharia by nonviolent means, by appealing to various advantages that it may provide or may claim to provide. These are all jihads. And so somebody in the United States who is working completely nonviolently to stigmatize and demonize opponents of Sharia, to claim that Sharia is completely benign and that Americans are just religiously bigoted if they don't accept it, he's engaging in a jihad just as much as somebody on the battlefield is.
To say nothing if they are raising funds to support the jihadists who are actually doing the heavy lifting of the violent jihad. No?
Absolutely, yes. That's another important aspect of the jihad, that zakat, the obligatory almsgiving that's one of the pillars of Islam, is meritoriously given for the cause of jihad. And so you have to wonder, when you look around the world and we see groups like Boko Haram in Nigeria and Al-Shabaab in Somalia and the Islamic State in so many areas now in Afghanistan and resurgent in Iraq and Syria, who's financing this? How is it that these groups are able to gain any traction? And it's because of Muslims around the world who believe that they are doing the right thing and that they are good organizations because they're waging jihad for the sake of Allah. And thus they support them not by taking up arms themselves, but by making sure that they get their financial support.
And the practical effect of that is, of course, to enable the violent jihad. Now, Robert, I've described you as what I regard as one of the country's preeminent, certainly non-Muslim experts on Sharia, jihad, the tenets of Islam more broadly. Just if you would, is it simply your opinion that you've just shared with us, or is what you've described absolutely beyond debate, really, established in the sacred texts of Islam and the interpretations thereof of the authorities of the faith going back, well, over a millennium, not just in our own time?
Absolutely. There are a lot of people who would like you to believe that what I'm giving you is just my own opinion, but they ignore the fact and hope that you will ignore the fact that all the schools of Islamic jurisprudence, both Sunni and Shiite, all the various sects of Islam, they all teach the necessity to wage jihad in order to impose Sharia over everywhere that it's possible to do so. And this is not something that is some tiny sect that's marginalized rejected by the other groups of Muslims. On the contrary, this is something that, as I show in my book, The History of Jihad, has been pursued consistently around the world for 1,400 years. And there has never been a rejection or a reformation or a reconsideration of the doctrines that power it. They are still considered to be in force. And so while not all Muslims will take them up any more than all Christians follow all Christian doctrines, there are some who will. And those who do believe that they are justified because these are the teachings of the Quran and Sunnah.
And unfortunately, quite a number of Muslims, I think you're right to point out that some have made clear they don't want to live under Sharia any more than the rest of us do. But an awful lot of those who fall into the category of neither rejecting Sharia nor, you know, fully embracing it and seeking to impose it on others are people who are sort of on the fence and are listening, you know, to their imams' sermons and injunctions, and evidently at least recognizing that those who are doing the jihad in furtherance of what Sharia requires are, you know, legitimate in their pursuit of their faith. And if not to be actually embraced or supported financially through zakat or other means, at least to be recognized as part of the program of Islam, not repudiated. Have I got that right?
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. The problem that we're facing in the United States is really compounded to a tremendous degree by the denial at all levels and the high acceptance of the misinformation and disinformation that's put out by the Council on American Islamic Relations and others, such that people have no idea that this kind of thing is happening or that there are people in the United States who believe these things and are working to bring their beliefs to fruition. This is just not on the radar.
Yeah, we're going to talk about a couple of examples of how much this is present in our country. But let me just stay with this question of policy makers or policy shapers, elected officials, would-be elected officials, or people appointed. For example, we've talked in recent weeks about the appointment by President Biden, Robert Spencer, of a man by the name of Rashad Hussein to become the next U.S. ambassador at large for international religious freedom. And as you have helped us, call attention to, he is a man who's sufficiently devout in terms of the practice of his faith that he has said by no less an authority than Barack Obama that he has memorized every word of this very large volume known as the Quran. The question, again, recurs. Can a man who has deeply imbued himself with Sharia, which of course is built on the Quran, among other texts, approach the principle inherent in our constitution, inherent in our society, in our traditions, in our values, of religious freedom for all, meaning that all are equally entitled to enjoy it and practice it unrestrained by others of other faiths? Can he possibly square those two sort of basic operating codes, if you will, Sharia with its supremacism and the Constitution and everything with its commitment to equality of religious freedom? And by the way, of people who choose to leave religions like Islam or simply have no religious belief at all?
Well, you know, Frank, he's either going to have to ignore one or the other, ignore the basic tenets of one or the other. For example, when you note that the question also arises for people who are leaving Islam, this is because most people don't know this, but Islam does have a death penalty for apostates. And so whether Rashad Hussein is ever going to put somebody to death, of course not. But he might think in principle, as a matter of fact, he would be a disloyal Muslim who would not be abiding by the tenets of Islam if he thought that apostates, people who leave Islam, should not be put to death. So if there comes up a case while he is at the Religious Freedom Agency, if there comes up a case of somebody leaving Islam and is persecuted, how much is he going to think that that is something that the United States ought to be making a statement about or trying to aid this person? And, you know, you also look at, for example, Nigeria. Nigeria was just taken off the list of the violators of religious freedom. Now, this is an appalling decision by someone in the Biden administration. We don't know who. And they have completely ignored the fact that Christians are persecuted in Nigeria by Muslims on the basis of Islamic texts and teachings on practically a daily basis. On almost every day at Jihad Watch, I have a story about another jihad massacre of Christians in Nigeria. And so to say that Nigeria is not a violator of religious freedom, when the government has consistently turned a blind eye and just paid lip service to this problem and never done anything to eradicate the groups that are carrying out this persecution. And as a matter of fact, there's evidence that some high-level people in the Nigerian government are sympathetic to the persecutors. They're the people that's the country that should be on the religious freedom violators list most of all.
Country of particular concern, I think, is the euphemism that the State Department uses. But you're right. They took them off. They took them off the CPC list, as it's known, on the eve of Tony Blinken, our Secretary of State, going to Nigeria to address, among other things, the importance of international religious freedom there. I mean, it was just ignominious in the extreme, it seems to me, and such a betrayal. And Robert, let me just say, I've long admired and enthused about jihadwatch.org, but the work that you've been doing in documenting, as you say, practically daily, this jihad that is underway in Nigeria is one of your finest moments and most important contributions, I think, to our situational awareness, as the military calls it, about the nature of jihad in our time. And what the administration has done here, I don't know whether Rashad Hussein was consulted on it or not. That seems to me to be another important question that ought to be put to him before the senators take up his nomination, decide whether to confirm him to a post that will be, I think you're absolutely right, inherently conflicted for him, given on the one hand his attachment to Sharia and on the other hand his putative commitment, at least his responsibility to promote religious freedom for all. And Robert, again, in your works, and there's so many of them, but the truth about Islam and the books about jihad and all the rest really make one point central, it seems to me, and that is that when you are a devout Muslim, you must regard other faiths as inferior. You must treat them in a manner that, is supremacist with respect to your own belief system and practices, no?
Yeah, the Quran calls the Muslims the best of people. That's chapter 3, verse 110. And the non-Muslims are the most vile of created beings. That's chapter 98, verse 6. So
Robert, I just have to ask, because it's sometimes said that, well, you know, you can find in the Bible the verse that calls for violence or the passage that suggests that the Jews or the Christians, for that matter, are, you know, superior to all others. But when you look at the totality of the Quran, which, of course, you have done with great care, are you cherry-picking these kinds of quotes, which you've shared with us in the past as well as just now?
I would challenge anybody who claims that to produce a passage of the Quran that teaches clearly that non-Muslims are equal in dignity before God, before the law, before whatever standard you want, equal in dignity to Muslims. That is there something in the Quran that says that non-Muslims are valuable as human beings have a right to live are just as good as Muslims in terms of their basic human dignity. There is no such passage. On the contrary, chapter 48, verse 29 says, Muhammad is the apostle of Allah. Those who follow him are ruthless to unbelievers, merciful amongst themselves. So this is just the opposite of the Judeo-Christian ethos of all human beings being equal with dignity before God. And anybody who wants to accuse me of cherry picking should prove their case by producing the passages of the Quran that teach the equality of dignity of all people, the equality of rights of women with men, the necessity for peaceful coexistence and not jihad warfare for supremacy. If they produce those passages, I will publicly acknowledge they're correct.
Let's just say one more time. There are Muslims who clearly do not practice their faith in accordance with those Quranic precepts. They are, I think, regarded generally unfavorably, to say the least, by the authorities of the faith, if not actually as apostates. But that's what goes again back to this point. When you are talking about people being either elected or appointed to offices in our country where they swear an oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States, that can be at odds with the teachings of Islam that some of them may regard as more important. Divinely directed and their guiding principle, that needs to be teased out before they're voted into office or confirmed for senior positions like Rashad Hussein's, it seems to me. Let me just ask you, Robert, about a matter involving, I think, what one would call a Sharia supremacist, a fellow by the name of Ajmal Amani, who came to a rather unpleasant end in San Francisco the other day. Remind us who he was and what transpired.
Ajmal Amani was an Afghan who served for several years as an interpreter for the U.S. military in Afghanistan. And then he was admitted to the U.S. as a refugee a few years ago. He almost immediately began to show that he had violent tendencies. He attacked a man with a box cutter a few years back and was actually charged with attempted murder. The charge was dropped, but nonetheless, the situation was one of serious concern. And then on just a few days ago in San Francisco, he charged at police with a knife, 6-inch kitchen knife, while screaming, Allahu Akbar, and that's when he was shot. The question is, Ajmal Amani was completely vetted, was considered to be someone who was on our side. But because the United States is institutionally committed to ignoring the jihad, ignoring the assumptions and beliefs and attitudes that lead to jihad violence, they never saw this coming with this man. And this raises the question also of what are we getting ourselves into by bringing over 82,000 refugees who the Biden administration has now admitted have not been vetted, and they're already in the United States.
This is really terrifying.
The idea of the...
Yeah, this fellow, Amani was deemed to be one of those who's entitled to be here because of the help he gave to our troops in Afghanistan. Turns out, probably not, in fact, but certainly the question occurs, Robert Spencer, what on earth have we brought into America, put on military bases, no less, across this country, and now increasingly turning loose on the civilian population in terms of these unvetted persons? It's truly chilling. Let me finally turn to one other somewhat humorous, but in a way, very telling example of the problem we've just been discussing. There is a congresswoman by the name of Ilhan Omar, who represents, I think, primarily a Somali expat population in Minnesota, who got into something of a set-to with another female member of Congress, Lauren Boebert of Colorado, this week. Tell us what went down and what has come of it. I think maybe it was last week, but tell us what was afoot.
A video was released of Lauren Boebert speaking to a group of constituents and making a joke about Ilhan Omar and saying that she found herself in an elevator with Omar, and a concerned Capitol Police officer rushed up to the elevator door, and Lauren Boebert said, don't worry, she's not wearing a backpack, I should be okay. And this has been taken to be a tremendous, terrible insult and wound to the body politic that a politician would speak in this way. And Ilhan Omar has even claimed that Boebert's joke endangers her and all Muslims. Now, this is this classic victimhood posturing that we see again and again and again from Islamic supremacists. And what's ironic about it is that Omar has been repeatedly criticized for her anti-Semitic statement. And it's interesting that nobody ever said her anti-Semitic statements are endangering all Jews. But that's the same kind of thing, that if you say something critical or mocking, like Ilhan Omar did, that American support for Israel was all about the Benjamins and so on, that if you say something like that, then you're physically endangering people. This is part of the left's ongoing practice of claiming that any words of conservatives, any words of their opponents that they don't like are violence, are essentially violent in themselves.
And so more to the point, Robert,
they have to be silent.
Yeah, there's a double standard, in fact, that the left has the freedom to say anything they want about anybody, no matter how disparaging it might be or how perhaps inflammatory it might be, but no one on the right is entitled to do it. I've seen a video that Lauren Boebert has put out in which she describes her efforts to mollify Ilhan Omar by making several apologies to her by phone and having gotten nothing but more crap from the Minnesota congresswoman, and having, I have to say, it sounds like given back a fair measure of it herself as a result. But the point is, these are not simple matters of some sort of perceived slight or discourtesy. These are really going to the heart in some ways of what does Ilhan Omar believe when she really denounces America as a terrorist entity? What does she mean when she is reviling people of other faiths? What does she mean when she swears an oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States? All of those seem to me, especially against the backdrop of this very important conversation with you, Robert Spencer, are worth our careful, thoughtful examination. So we appreciate you doing that with us, Robert. We look forward to having another one in the near future. In the meantime, thank you for the work you do at jihadwatch.org. I hope everybody will keep abreast of it as I try to do. God bless you, my friend. We'll talk with you soon. Next up, we'll speak with Sam Faddis about the world of hurt we're in and what we best be doing about it right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and it's a pleasure to say we are joined by one of our favorite guests. His name is Charles Sam Faddis. He has an extraordinary record of service to our country over decades, including as an officer in the United States Army, as a clandestine services officer in the Central Intelligence Agency for some 20 years, as a deputy attorney general in Washington State, and as a candidate for Congress, the author of a number of books, both fiction and nonfiction, including Beyond Repair, The Decline and Fall of the Central Intelligence Agency. Sam Faddis is also the driving force on an absolutely indispensable online resource called andmagazine.com. And we always are interested in examining with him and with you some of the findings of that research and analysis, and we're going to do that today. Sam Faddis, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's so good to have you, sir.
Great to be here, Frank. Thank you.
You really caught my eye and in a way contributed to my own commentary on the subject today, namely with your essay about can we vaccinate our way out of this pandemic, which is what basically we are now being hectored to believe, that not only is that the only way that we can get out of this pandemic, but that we have to redouble the effort with any number of booster shots that are now going to be required of us, not just the first two of these gene therapies that are now described as vaccines by our government. Talk through what you've come to understand about what's going on here, Sam, and its implications.
Well, the reality is that it's pretty simple. I mean, the virus, these kinds of virus, the COVID viruses mutate at an astonishingly rapid rate. They mutate much faster than we can develop new vaccines. So by the time you have developed a vaccine for any variant of this virus, that virus is essentially extinct, and we have moved on to subsequent mutations, and therefore the vaccine is useless. So you're vaccinating against a virus that is extinct. The other thing to keep in mind here is that because of the way these vaccines work, and there is some dispute as to whether they should even be called vaccines, they provide at best a very narrow immunity against the specific strain of the virus for which they were designed to counter. So they do not confer the equivalent, anything like the equivalent of natural immunity. If you get COVID and you are exposed to COVID and you recover from it, your body effectively, using layman's terms, acquires this broad immunity. It will very rapidly recognize future variants, and you will fight it off, and you will have natural immunity as we have come to understand it in the course of our daily lives against other diseases. The vaccines don't work that way. So if you got vaccinated against Alpha or Delta or whatever, that's the only variant really against which you have immunity. And therefore, as the virus mutates, it's really easier to think of it as turning into another disease almost, you have no immunity. And you can see this you can see the reality of this. Even as authorities kind of pretend that that's not the case, you can see in their actions that they understand this fully. So recently, when this Omicron variant appeared in Southern Africa that everybody's up in arms about whether they should be or not, one of the first states on the nation states on the planet to lock down and cut off travel to Southern Africa was Israel, the most vaccinated nation on Earth. So virtually everybody in Israel has been vaccinated, and yet instantaneously they recognized that that vaccine would confer no protection against the new variant. So no, we cannot vaccinate our way out of this. The only way out of this is the acquisition of natural immunity by most of the population.
Now, Sam, again, both of us are lay people. You've been closely following these developments, and I think have as a result a considerable amount of insight. My understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that it would be bad enough if the vaccines are not helpful as the virus mutates. But there seems to be some basis for concern that, in fact, you may be worse off having been vaccinated, that your immune system may have been suppressed in ways that would make more devastating, potentially, these diseases as they evolve, and you're less and less capable of contending with them. Is that right, based on your own research and that the people you're talking to?
And I should add that I'm not just sort of doing this, you know, this is not just sort of my opinion as a lay guy that sat around and read some articles on the internet. I mean, this is based on consultation with a lot of people, including Dr. Hatfield, who is, you know, the guy who wrote our pandemic response plan, which was completely disregarded when the pandemic started, one of our top guys in biodefense. So there are exactly the issue you've outlined. There's also a growing body of evidence, of course, that we're having some serious negative health effects on people from taking the vaccine, including serious heart problems. There's also another
quite apart issue here, quite apart from these mutations, you're
because
saying
we're not acquiring natural immunity,
the condition
as a population, and because the virus can continuously find ways around the narrow immunity the vaccine gives, as it mutates, it may in fact become much more dangerous and much more lethal. So if you were exposed to the original variant, as I was, you went through weeks of malaise and coughing and it wasn't fun, but you recovered. If the virus in fact becomes more dangerous as it goes along, as these variants continue to appear, and if you've been vaccinated but have no natural immunity, what you're going to then experience potentially is exposure to one of what could be much more lethal strains of the virus without natural immunity. So I should emphasize that this is not carved in stone. As the virus mutates, it also may become weaker. In fact, Omicron actually seems to be less dangerous, if you will. But there are also projections that the virus could mutate in ways where we approach 30% lethality, something on the order of smallpox. And if that actually happens, if, big capital letters, if, and you're now having that variant rage through a population that still doesn't have natural immunity, then you will have actually created a true pandemic, a true disaster. So in all respects, this reliance on vaccination is horribly misguided.
And again, excuse me. And again, it's not just vaccination. It is this insistence that everybody must be vaccinated and that they must be vaccinated with, the first of what I think it's reasonable to expect will be a series of booster shots, don't you? Especially as we chase various variants of this disease.
What you're looking at, if you continue down this road of this focus on vaccination, is they call them boosters, but they're not boosters. It's a new vaccination. You are chasing your tail endlessly. You are attempting to get ahead of the cycle by vaccinating, revaccinating, revaccinating, but you can't ever scientifically match the speed with which the virus mutates. So you will do this forever. And there is, in fact, now discussion being trotted out seriously that essentially everybody's going to have to be vaccinated every 3 months. So we've gone from the representation that we would get vaccinated, the pandemic would be over, and we would move on, to a situation in which the pandemic will never end. We will have perpetuated it by virtue of this. And obviously, there are very powerful interests pushing that. Big Pharma is set to make more money than they have ever even contemplated making. And those folks who have an interest in sort of just stomping all over your constitutional rights and expanding dramatically the scope of government power, this is a godsend for them. They, for the rest of time, they can suppress all of your constitutional rights, claiming that this is the only way we can survive this pandemic.
This was the subject of my commentary, Sam, and I just wonder, you've written about something that Pastor Steve Ciccolanti shared with us yesterday, namely the extreme that now is in evidence in this regard in terms of controlling a population. In Australia, talk a bit about what is happening down under that may be a very ominous foreshadowing of what similarly minded politicians would like to do here.
Well, literally in Australia, we're now seeing the emergence of what amount to concentration camps. I mean, internment camps, where you move populations that are, you know, deemed unsafe, which is insane, which is the plot of a really bad novel had you written it 5 years ago. And yet this is the reality in a liberal democratic country that we think of as, you know, a fellow nation coming out of the English common law tradition. I would also add, and again, this is another one of those things that you and I talk about all the time that kind of sounds like it should be science fiction, and yet it's reality. Once you establish this predicate, which we are rapidly doing, that you can simply throw out the Constitution by declaring a health emergency, then anything else you label as a health emergency will also command that. I mean, you'll also be able to justify the same measures. And already, this is not kidding, You can see all over the web articles appearing that climate change also constitutes a health emergency. Now, once you've decided that none of your constitutional rights matter if it's a health emergency, well, then it would apply to anything else. So the government will now tell you what kind of automobile you can drive, how far you can drive it, if you can drive it at all, what the temperature is in your house, presumably anything else they can conceivably connect to climate change will now be declared a health emergency. And there's probably no end to the number of things that they can attach that label to. I mean, it's a basic legal principle. Once we've established the precedent that you don't have any constitutional rights, if the government says you don't, well, then they're gone.
And probably permanently, needless to say. Sam, I think you've been participating in a very important project of our Committee on the Present Danger, China, with our colleague Reggie Littlejohn and her Women's Rights Without Frontiers. It's called the Stop Vaccine Passports Task Force. And one of the reasons we've been so concerned about the flip side of the mandates for these vaccines, namely that there has to be an enforcement mechanism, is that it's a very short step, if any, really, to a full-on Chinese Communist Party-style social credit system that would be instituted in this country. And if you talk about the kind of controlling of behavior and actions and freedoms that you've just described, whether it's for medical reasons or the so-called public health implications of climate change, this is a mechanism that can actually give the government the power to exercise that kind of restraint on us and as you say, permanently crush our freedoms. Is that overstating the danger we face in this regard?
No, it's not at all. And this adaptation of Chinese methodology, we've already seen, lockdowns were never part of any national pandemic plan. No one ever contemplated, discussed, or suggested the idea of locking down a healthy population. There were discussion of quarantining specific people who were sick with a communicable disease to keep them away from the healthy population. Nobody ever suggested, ever, in American pandemic planning, the idea, the insane idea of locking down a healthy population. It is a Chinese Communist Party methodology they employed when this virus appeared in their country. And then in lockstep, our bureaucracy and our politicians take that Chinese methodology and apply it. That is fact. And we're about, you know, one heartbeat away from turning this focus on vax mandates into a full-blown Chinese social credit system where you won't be able to move anywhere, do anything, buy anything without being tracked by the government. And if you haven't complied with their edicts, i.e. gotten a vax, you don't have that ability. You can't travel. You won't go through a toll booth anymore. You won't board a train, a plane, get a job, buy groceries. Your credit cards won't work. That's all technologically possible right now.
And well, more than that, it's being practiced in China right now, which brings me to my next topic with you, Sam. And you've written about this in various ways for some time now. And you've done, by the way, heroic work documenting these concerns. It's not just sort of your off the top of your head apprehension. You have researched both what we know to this point about President Biden and his deep compromise by the Chinese Communist Party, and what we've been seeing in terms of his policies on the one hand and his personnel choices on the other. I think about the latter, you've said he's basically put into place Xi Jinping's dream team. And you have sort of pulled all of this together in a new piece at AND Magazine yesterday entitled, Do We Have a Chinese Spy in the White House? And I'd like you to just take a few minutes to walk us through the answer to that question, as you see.
Well, let me approach this sort of through the lens of Hunter Biden's laptop, right? Hunter Biden's laptop gets abandoned at this repair place, and it sort of surfaces in the run-up to the election of 2020. And it is filled with evidence of a gigantic influence peddling machine for which Hunter Biden is the bagman, and which connects him, the Biden family in general, the Biden crime family, to hostile authoritarian regimes all over the world. It's kind of buried by the press because they just don't want to talk about this and because it can obviously derail Joe's campaign. Some media outlets like the New York Post never stopped talking about it. To their credit, most did. Now it's sort of percolating back to the surface. But what I try to point out in the most recent article of the AND Magazine is, okay, so now we're sort of focusing on the sordid stories of Hunter Biden and prostitutes and drugs. And now we're beginning to talk about the fact that Hunter himself is obviously horribly corrupt and awash in foreign money. And what we're still missing is, to me, the biggest piece of this, which is overwhelmingly most of this money that ends up in the hands of the Bidens comes from the Communist Chinese, from the Chinese Communist Party. And it comes to them through a series of companies and individuals directly tied to Chinese leadership and directly involved in Chinese intelligence activities. And for instance, the CEFC, this energy company that people may have heard about, which is really nothing but a front organization for what's called Chinese United Front activities, which are well-known, well-documented, real activities by the Chinese to execute what they call leadership capture or elite capture. It is the co-opting, buying, and controlling of foreign leaders. So they will then do the bidding of the Chinese. Not science fiction, documented. The FBI has talked about this endlessly. Everybody knows this is reality. And a number of these folks, including some of them with whom the Bidens were in direct contact, have in fact been convicted and sent to prison for intelligence activities doing exactly this. So the real issue here is that we have the Biden family, which includes Joe, clearly, by virtue of this evidence, directly involved with Chinese intelligence and taking money from entities tied directly to Chinese intelligence. They weren't giving that money out of the goodness of their heart. They weren't just throwing it away. They were buying something, which means we got a guy sitting in the Oval Office who has taken, depending on how you want to count it, literally billions of dollars from the Chinese Communist Party, from entities that we can document are part of their United Front activities, and that we know for sure have the express purpose of buying and controlling foreign leaders. This is the biggest counterintelligence issue we have ever faced, because potentially we have a foreign agent sitting in the White House. And yet, as far as I can tell, our entire counterintelligence apparatus and law enforcement apparatus is just pretending like they can't see any of this and ignoring the implications.
And focusing instead on the so-called domestic terrorism threat of
absolutely. Got to arrest those school board moms. Those are a threat.
Yeah. Sam, again, you've spent most of your professional life in the business of intelligence, dealing with extremely sensitive operations and secrets and capabilities that are central to the defense of our nation. You've done it at great personal risk and sacrifice, and we owe you an enormous debt of gratitude for that. Most of it will never be properly understood, let alone acknowledged, of course, but still, it gives you a vantage point for doing a damage assessment on what the implications of this could be. I keep coming back to something that just, you know, strikes me, again, more or less as a layman, as appalling, which is the possibility that you know, basically Joe Biden in these interminable conversations with Xi Jinping is actually taking dictation as to what Xi expects him to do next, and whether those conversations contributed to his policies on Afghanistan or his policies on the South China Sea or his policies on climate change or heavens knows what all else, certainly his personnel choices. This is a way of trying to make somewhat more tangible what you just said, which is, you know, this is a huge counterintelligence disaster, potentially. And I just would ask you to just further reflect very quickly, because we're almost out of time, on how serious the repercussions could be for our country if this is indeed the case, that there's a Manchurian president, as you say, in the Oval Office.
Well, world-changing, catastrophic. I mean, is there any limit to how bad this can be? Grab a hold of the Taiwan situation. We have the just the aerial incursions are dramatically increasing almost daily. Is there anybody on the planet who could seriously look at this evidence and what we have just talked about and tell me that they seriously believe that if the Chinese take an effort to blockade Taiwan, invade Taiwan, that Joe Biden is going to do anything meaningful? Absolutely not. And you can look all over the world at any catastrophe you can imagine and see that he's not going to lift a finger. I mean, when we're done
with this, we're going to have to explore this further with you.
Geopolitical situation be changed.
Yeah, in the near future, Sam Faddis, I hope it'll be next week. In the meantime, I thank you so much for what you've given to us today. Keep up the great work, my friend, at andmagazine.com. Follow him there, folks, and follow us to our next show tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Afton. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
History was made on today's date. Stay tuned for an American Minute with Bill Federer.
The celebrated jumping frog of Calaveras County was his first popular story, written while in San Francisco. He then sailed to Palestine and wrote the book Innocence Abroad. While on this trip, he saw a picture of his friend's sister, Olivia, and fell in love. Immediately upon his return, he met and married her, and under her encouragement, his writing greatly improved. His name was Mark Twain, born this day, November 30th, 1835. Regarding the Holy Land, Mark Twain wrote, "Our Savior spent his life preaching his gospel and performing his miracles within a compass no larger than an ordinary county of the United States."
This has been an American Minute with Bill Federer. For a free transcript, call American Minute at 1-888-USA-WORD.